This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn about the Sex Offender Registry from NARSOL, the National Association for Rational Sex Offense Laws. Being on the registry brands you for life and brings continuing stigma no matter what the crime and long after you've served your sentence. The Federalist Society has shifted the United States political and legal landscape to the right. Joining us today is Michael Avery, attorney and author of The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. He'll tell us how this happened. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Here's an update that represents a significant victory for activists. Last week, the Minnesota Supreme Court ordered that a groundbreaking climate protest case could proceed. This sets the stage for what should be one of the nation's first trials involving the so-called necessity defense around climate change. It stems from a 2016 act of civil disobedience. Four defendants helped to turn off the flow of tar sands oil through a cross-border pipeline. The case has worked its way through the court system, and prosecutors have tried and failed again and again to prevent the defendants from presenting evidence about the dangers of climate change and the need for direct action. So last week's decision leaves in place a lower court decision allowing the activists to present this necessity defense. That rarely happens. There have been a few other significant advances in recognizing the climate necessity defense. In March, a Massachusetts judge held that several activists were not responsible, by reason of necessity, for their actions in a series of anti-pipeline protests in Boston. In Spokane, a trial judge allowed an activist who had blocked coal and oil trains to present a climate necessity defense before a jury. And prosecutors are currently appealing that decision, no surprise. Other cases involving the Shut It Down protest, in which the Minnesota defendants participated, have seen judges reject activists' right to present their preferred evidence, but those are currently being appealed. Back to the Minnesota case, in April, the Minnesota Court of Appeals wrote in an unpublished opinion that, quote, necessity is an effective defense to a criminal charge if the harm that would have resulted from compliance with the law would have significantly exceeded the harm actually resulting from the defendant's breach of the law. And that judge found that the defendant's evidence met this test. Alice Cherry, who's a staff attorney from the Climate Defense Project, a legal nonprofit that's representing the Minnesota activist and other climate necessity defendants, said, quote, the upcoming trial will be a referendum on failed climate policy and the need for nonviolent civil disobedience. Other attorneys who are working on the case are two guild members, actually, Tim Phillips of Minneapolis and Lauren Reagan from the Civil Liberties Defense Center. A scheduling order from the trial court is expected in the coming weeks, and Law and Disorder sends our heartfelt congratulations to everyone involved in this important victory. Taylor Boncall was a 22-year-old student teacher and track coach at Conrad High School in West Hartford, Connecticut. This past February, she was arrested and charged with three counts of second-degree sexual assault for having a consensual relationship with an 18-year-old student there. The young man had initiated the relationship, and he was not a member of the track team, nor was he a student of hers. If convicted of sexual assault, Ms. Boncall will have to register as a sex offender. Doing so will most likely alter the course of her life. NARSOL stands for the National Association for Rational Sex Offense Laws. It is a nationally recognized nonprofit dedicated to restoring the civil and constitutional rights of registered sex offenders. In this case, NARSOL believes that criminal charges are unwarranted. The group contends that any law that allows an adult to be criminally prosecuted for a consensual relationship with another adult should be abolished. Joining us today to talk about the state of sexual offender laws in the United States, this case, and others, is Brenda Jones, NARSOL's executive director. Brenda has been involved in this cause since 2009. She has been executive director of the state affiliate FAIR, Families Advocating for Intelligent Registries, since its inception in 2010. And in 2012, she became the first executive director of NARSOL. Brenda Jones, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Brenda, tell me, if I'm convicted of a sexually based offense, what will happen to me after I serve my prison sentence?
Well, as is the case with many laws, it will depend a little on what state you're in and the laws in that particular state. But there's a very, very good chance that based on whatever sexually based conviction you have, that you would be assigned to a certain period of time on the public registry. Most states put just about everybody on the public sex offender list.
I thought that was for life. So it varies according to the state and the offense.
It does. It
okay.
does. There are some states that are entirely lifetime, no matter what, from minor offenses to the really major ones. There are others that actually have a range, usually anywhere from 10 years to life.
And in a general sense, I know it varies, but are there other post-sentence sort of penalties that attach? Requirements that you can't live near a school, things like that?
That will also vary widely by states. There are some states that have pretty severe what we call residency restrictions, and that would require they can't live within X distance, anywhere from 500 feet to, gosh, there's one state that's trying to pass a 5,000-foot one, but generally it stops at 2,000 or 2,500 feet within a distance from a school or a playground or whatever they've defined as places where children gather. So that's one that would attach to registration. Sometimes it's just a proximity restriction, which means you can't be on the property where there are children. And this applies, again, regardless of whether your offense actually had anything to do with children.
Oh, right.
So it's
okay.
Just whatever your offense is, you can't be, you know, on that property. And, yeah, and it just those are things that have been added on. If you are required to register, then you must do this. There are states that have marks on driver's licenses. There are so that no matter where you have to flash your ID, it'll say sex offender on it.
Like a scarlet letter.
It totally.
I didn't know that.
Yep. There are some states, mostly in the South, that have that. So those are just a few of the things.
Now, if I'm applying for a job, is this the kind of thing I have to divulge?
Yes. If you don't, you could try to get away with not divulging it during the interview. You know, there's a lot of ban the box efforts out there right now. But, again, depending on the state, once you do have that job, if you're registered, you will have to report that job. And, you know, that's one of the things you have to register. And that may or may not mean that your place of employment will then suddenly be posted on the web. It would also mean, in many instances, that police or somebody else that's checking on people who are registered will show up at your employer's door and say, did you know that so-and-so was a registrant? So needless to say, that kind of puts a crimp in your application process. And so there's a lot of discussion, you know, should I tell them now? Should I tell them later? Eventually a background check gets run, and sometimes that does it.
So
it's extremely difficult.
So if I'm on the registry, you're saying that officials check up periodically on me?
Yes, definitely. depending on the state, first you have to report and update at a certain interval, and that can be anywhere from once a year to once every quarter to, if perchance you are homeless, you are frequently required to come in like weekly, which makes so much sense when you're homeless that you would be able to show up at law enforcement and tell them where you're sleeping. But then they also have various ways of checking to make sure you where you say you are. So they would come knocking on your door. They would call. They arrange to come along with U.S. Marshals and make a big production of it and invite the press to come along so everybody knows how safe they are. Yeah.
No.
yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of like being on parole.
It kind
Only
of is.
Only they come
yeah.
to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, probation could come to you as well. But
yeah.
but you might go to them, you might check in, but there's an awful lot of being on the registry that even if you're done with your sentence, and one thing to remember is that the registry goes on irrespective of what your actual punishment is. So say you had, your sentence was for, say, 2 years in prison, another 2 years of probation, but that in your state you have lifetime registration. So you could be done with all your punishment, everything the court ordered, and you still have to show up and get booked. You know, which is basically what it amounts to, once, twice, four times a year. That can include right up to fingerprinting and, to handing over all of this information, police showing up at your door to check and make sure you're where you say you are, knocking on the neighbor's door if you don't happen to be there, leaving bright red signs on your door to say, we were here and you weren't, for everybody to see.
I had no idea.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that goes.
Let mm-hmm. me ask you this. So the registry is website accessible.
Yes.
So using me again as an example, if I'm on the registry, someone can go look it up. They will see my name. Will they see my address?
Most likely. That varies by state. There are a few states that don't put the whole address. They might put a block number. But chances are, yes, your address would be there.
Will the nature of my offense be listed?
Most states do, which is public information.
Right,
Because, of course, by the time you're on the registry, you've got a public record
of
a particular offense. But it will be put there, and they try to do it in quote-unquote plain language so that you would get they would go there and it would say offense against a child under the age of 14 and involved two or three people, whatever it might have been. They don't just say statute blah blah blah, which of course means no sense to most people.
Right.
So that they want to make sure that the average person can look at that and say, oh, I see, it's that type of offense.
Is there a photograph on there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yes.
So my photo will be there.
Yeah, and you get a new photo every time you check in. So that photo will be up to date. That's why I say it's like a booking when you go to register. Yeah, you get a new photo, oftentimes fingerprinting, and that all gets updated. The offense, it'll say when it was, but the picture is current. And so the impression given by anybody looking it up is that it happened yesterday. Right, because
it
might have been 20,
right?
It might have been 20 years ago. You might have been, 19, and your girlfriend was 14, and you got a slap on the wrist, and now you're both married and you're 40 years old, but none of that shows up in there. All you see is your new 50-year-old picture with a sex crime against a 14-year-old.
Right. It's almost as if it renews every year and during the year.
Yeah.
Brenda, given the stigma that attaches to this, isn't being on the registry a form of additional punishment in your view?
I would say yes. And I think most people would assume that the registry is a continued punishment. And yet it is, legally in most states, it's considered to be just a regulatory scheme. The same way there would be, they regulate how guns are sold, or whether or not a person who's a felon can own a gun is the example I like to use. You know, if you're a felon, most states oftentimes restrict your use of weapons, regardless of what your crime is. So that would be an example. So it's just considered a civil regulation that the legislature has established, and the only way that it can be called punishment as a result of that is through the courts. So somebody has to file a civil challenge and say, "Hey, I think you've crossed a line. This isn't just showing up and you know, registering my name once a year. You know, I've got all these restrictions. I've got all this, you know, booking, all this stuff going on, and I think that qualifies as punishment." And then, you know, the courts have to weigh, you know, different arguments and make a decision. And there have been some decisions that have come down that have said, yep, you crossed the line.
And so, have there been reforms as a result of that?
It's a struggle. I'm going to be horrible with case names, but there's a case out of Michigan fairly recently that basically declared their registry to be punitive, and yet it's been 2 years, and I think not even the plaintiffs have seen a change. The ACLU just filed an appeal, like in the last week or two. It what happens is it gets kicked back to the legislature. You know, hey guys, you created this law, it's punitive, you've gone too far, fix it. But no lawmaker wants to come out as saying, hey, we're going to make things easier for somebody who's committed a sex offense, because they're worried about not ever getting elected again. It's a real struggle.
Brenda, yeah. What do you say to members of the public who assert that they have a right to know if an offender moves into their neighborhood? What would you recommend as an alternative to the registry?
Well, my comeback there is generally that you have a right to look up records online. There is no other offense that gets that level of scrutiny. Take proper precautions. There are way more drug dealers who've gotten out of prison that might be living next door to you who are far more likely to come and proposition your kids with drugs than there is a sex offender that's likely to cause harm, because most sex offenders never offend again. So, you know, and use common sense. But there is no right to have public, you know, that public of information. It's already accessible by looking up court records. If somebody moves in next door, you can go look their name up. In most states, you can look up their name on the court records and see whether or not they've been convicted of something.
Yeah. Let me clarify something you just said. You said that most sex offenders aren't recidivist. They don't offend again. No?
No, they don't.
And that includes pedophiles?
Correct. There's actually, it's statistically speaking, the most persons who are convicted of a sexual offense across the board, obviously certain types of offense has a slightly higher rate than others, but across the board, the Department of Justice will throw out figures of between 3% and 5%. Studies in most states are showing 3% or less. Particular categories of person with a mental health issue, that sort of thing, can go up to maybe 20%. That's the higher end of what you see with most studies, compared to, say, drug offenders, compared to breaking and entering, which have a much, much higher rate. So you really have more reason to be concerned about somebody moving in next door who has been previously convicted of breaking and entering, or, again, of dealing drugs. And that would be more helpful to you because 90-some-odd percent of new sexual offenses are people who've never been caught. And so clearly registries are not the answer. The answer is finding prevention. It's finding ways to prevent an offense from happening in the first place.
I'm fascinated by the fact that with those low recidivist rates, compared, as you say, to drug-related offenses, what is the public policy argument for the registry? Is it based on the fact that we have a puritanical underpinnings in this society?
I think it's based on a lot of common misinformation that goes out there. Nothing personal, but the media hypes it. Sex sells, violence sells. So every day somewhere you hear a story about an abduction, you hear a story about rapes and so on, and yet the actual frequency is extremely low, especially, say, of child abductions. It's much, much lower than you would think based on what you see on the news. There have been like one or two studies that have actually been debunked by most people in the field that showed high rates of recidivism. And those get quoted constantly. The one that I love to, by people who want registries and tougher laws, the one I love to point out is a Canadian study that was of people who already recidivated. Okay, so this is your population. You know, they already reoffended, so you've got that body. As somebody, say, graduated from the program or dropped out because for some other reason, they got kicked out. So basically, the only people left were the ones that reoffended. And needless to say, that was a high, you know, so they were saying, oh, you know, like 50% of these people. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, that's not, it wasn't the intent of that study to show recidivism. It was just a part of a larger thing right. They were doing. And yet that gets quoted all the time still. And a Butner study that it also gets quoted a lot where the people in the prison were coerced, basically. Like, we have to report lots and lots of offenses or they won't let us move on to the next, you know, is that kind of thing. And that one's been debunked, but they love to quote those two. But, yeah, the vast majority of studies, including our own, you know, Department of Justice studies, show very, very low rates. Yeah. But it's just, I think people are misinformed, and it's very challenging to get past what once you've established a fear factor, a fear of the unknown, it's very hard to come back and say, hey, it's actually okay.
I think the so-called moral panic factor, as you say, sensationalism, legislators who want to appear tough on crime, the naming of, you know, Megan's Law and other sometimes hastily pass legislation that has a high emotional content to it.
Results
in poor legislation. I wanted to ask you, how does the United States compare to other countries in terms of laws like these and the registry? Are we alone?
Almost alone. There are other countries that have registries, Canada, Britain, Australia, and I'm probably missing a few because a couple more people are adding them. They tend to be private or almost exclusively private. So in other words, the people that are put on there, only law enforcement will see them, and they are monitored and generally risk assessed. So the term of time that they might spend on a registry will base more on an actual assessment of their risk to the public.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I suppose a concern would be that with a public registry like ours, you will see more instances of members of the public taking the law into their own hands. Fear getting out of control, someone blamed unjustly for something that happens. Have you seen instances of that?
There is a lot of that. Some of it gets reported. a lot of it doesn't, but it's anything from having your car egged to windows broken to houses getting burned down. There have been easily close to a dozen confirmed instances where somebody just decides, I'm taking out sex offenders, and they go around and have successfully managed to murder a number of them. Sometimes they go to a house that was on the registry, but the people inside are not registrants because the registrant moved, and there was a case there where a house got burned down. So, yeah, it's scary. So people that are on the registry and their families, these are not all, you know, that stereotypical guy in a trench coat. These are men and women with families, small children. All are targets at that point.
Now, before we talk specifically about some of the work you're doing, Brenda, at the top of the show, we referenced the case of Taylor Bonkall, the student teacher who had a consensual relationship with an 18-year-old student who wasn't under her supervision. Do you have an update on that case, and how common is that kind of arrest?
I would say that it's a fairly common situation. Certainly, any number of times there are teachers, student teachers, and older teachers with that situation. I do have a little bit of an update. It is secondhand, but a friend of the family who knew someone in our organization reported that that she was able to get accelerated rehabilitation, is the fancy term, which amounts to apparently 2 years of probation, and her record has been sealed, which we hope means that she might not need to end up on the registry, which is a very, very good outcome. Assuming all of this is accurate, there was probably a judge that got the message that this was a consensual relationship. It was between adults. There was no teacher-student relationship involved. Awkward, inappropriate, yeah, but there was still at least that slap on the wrist.
Mm-hmm. So it seems as though this is an issue, a problem of large proportions in this country. What is some of the work that NARSAL is doing to help reform the laws and educate people about what's going on?
Well, our big focus tends to be on registry issues. So we try to advocate and teach people to advocate in their local legislature. Because as I mentioned, it's the legislature of a state that actually has control over whether they can change the laws. So there's a lot of education that we're trying to do. Getting the word out about, like for instance, in this situation, we put out press releases when there are bills being put forward that are more get tough legislation. We try to have somebody that can be there to say, hey, wait a minute, let's look at the facts, let's look at the potential damage, the potential harm to children, frankly, from your legislation. It's not what you think it is. So we try to have people there in the legislature to at least block things from getting worse. And we're also working on filing lawsuits. We're just reaching the level as an organization that we can actually help fund either lawsuits or amicus briefs or other things to support support cases that are moving through the system that are challenging some of these excesses in the law.
So the registries are on the state level. There's no federal registry.
There is not per se. There is something called the Drew Sojan website, spelled like D-R-U, and then it's an odd last name, S-O-J-I-N, I think. But it's basically a compilation of all of the state and territory registries. So there's no separate registry that's just national.
And is this an individual that put that together or an organization?
The U.S. government.
Oh, I see. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Registries began like quick history 101.
Yes.
The first registry was created like 40-some-odd years ago in California. and it was specifically targeting, at that point, it tended to be targeting gays. It expanded to, because it was like sodomy laws back then.
Right.
But it's expanded, obviously. Every state now has one. Megan's Law came out in about 1990. That was one of the first named laws. And by that time, or within a few years of that, in the 90s, most states had some form of a registry. A lot of it was still law enforcement only access.
Right.
Then as we rolled on into the 2000s, the Adam Walsh Act, or SORNA, Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, was instituted. And in both instances, the national government kind of basically put a carrot out on a stick and said, hey, we'll give you more law enforcement money if you'll pump up your registries in a certain way.
Of course.
But it all came back down to the individual state registries. If the Adam Walsh Act were to be struck down tomorrow, all of those state registries would still be there. So
right.
That's why we at National RSOL are busy focusing on state legislatures.
Brenda, if you don't mm-hmm. mind sharing with us, I read that you got involved in this work back in 2009. Can you tell us briefly about the high-profile Maryland murder case that sparked your interest and why?
I can. It actually goes back a little bit further than that. 2009, 2008 is when a family member of mine was arrested and began serving time. And it was shortly after that that I really realized how crazy registry and sex offense laws had become. I just hadn't had any reason to pay attention before. And having just realized that, when I heard about this case, it was on the eastern shore of Maryland, very high profile, little girl that was, it was really a truly horrific crime by someone who was a sex offender. And a family had been invited to be a part of a family. So it was an internal family crime thing. It
right.
wasn't a stranger danger thing. But I saw that and I went, oh, this sounds like what's going to happen with the way it happened with Megan's Law and the way it happened with the Adam Walsh Act, with a named crime.
Right.
And sure enough, starting in January of that year when our legislation kicked in, bills started getting filed one after the other, all targeting sex offenders and sex offenses and registry increases. And I had no clue what the heck I was doing. Because I'm not a political person normally, but I just can't sit here and knowing what I know now and let it go. So that was how I got started.
Brenda, we'd like to link to your website on Law and Disorder, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know more about your work. What's the website?
You can find us at narsol.org. That's narsol.org. And there's a contact button, a blog, lots of good information, and lots of other links to further information from there.
And on your website, do you list any of the court cases that you've brought or are bringing?
Yes, we certainly do. I don't know if we have them all in a nice, tidy list, but we've certainly been posting blog notices about them, recent cases that have been won, cases that have been lost, and we'll be posting updates, of course, on any other cases that are moving through the system.
Well, before we let you go, Brenda, I just wanted to comment that when I was in law school years ago, I remember learning about so-called victim impact statements in court, and that's when family members or individuals who've been impacted by a certain crime are allowed to come and give a statement. And I always thought it was unfair that in addition to the facts of an offense, the emotional statements and presentations of individuals were allowed to factor in or, emotionally sway the mm-hmm. jurors. And this, mm-hmm. the work that you're doing reminds me very much of that. It seems as though we've created a body not only of laws, but this registry that's public that publicly shames individuals after they've served their sentences and, as you say, have such a low rate of recidivism. Any final comments on that?
I would say that's an apt description, and it's definitely feeding on everybody's worst fears. I mean, nobody wants children to be harmed, or adults for that matter, but it's a false boogeyman in most situations, what we've created, and we've stigmatized we've cleared 900,000 people in the country now that are on a registry, according to the National Council of Missing and Exploited Children. I think that's what it's called, NCMEC. And
900,000.
900,000 we've cleared. And, you know, many of those have families, spouses, children, parents who are they are living with or living with them who are equally stigmatized because of their address, because of the person that they're choosing to support, and destabilizing them, frankly, you know, because they cannot move forward easily in life. So, and all based really on knee-jerk reactions.
Well, Brenda, this has been an enlightening segment, and we want to thank you for this crucially important work that you're doing, and hope that in the future we can invite you to be back on for some updates.
I would love to be back on. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you, Brenda Jones. Have a great day.
And you as well.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
With the recent nomination of conservative attorney Brett Kavanaugh to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy, the U.S. Supreme Court will have a majority of anti-democratic jurists who support a powerful executive. At the same time, Donald Trump has been quick to appoint more conservatives to federal judgeships. More and more, we're hearing that the once little-known Federalist Society is behind these appointments. But that's not new. The Society was formed at Yale University in 1981. It has grown steadily and quietly in placing its attorney members in positions of power, both in the government and in the judiciary. In their 2013 book, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, attorneys Michael Avery and Danielle McLaughlin trace the movements of this small group of conservative law students and lawyers and their increasing influence. The Federalist Society has lawyer chapters in every major city in the U.S. and student chapters in every accredited law school. Members include economic conservatives, social conservatives, Christian conservatives, and even libertarians. One of the things that has made the Federalist Society so very effective is their big picture agenda. While they may have differences of opinion on a range of issues, they have successfully put those aside to advance a far-reaching, long-lasting, and broad conservative agenda. This agenda includes chipping away at social gains made since the 1930s. Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are on the block. So is Roe v. Wade and Citizens United, holding that corporations are persons and that money is free speech, as well as the union-breaking Janus decision. These are just the beginning. Other attacks on democracy include voter suppression, voter ID laws, and gerrymandering. Joining us now to discuss the recent shift in the Supreme Court and to update us on the Federalist Society is attorney Michael Avery. Michael is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and he's an expert in the areas of constitutional law and police misconduct. Welcome back to Law and Disorder, Michael.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Michael, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Federalist Society?
The Federalist Society has been around since 1982, when they had their first conference in New Haven at Yale Law School in April of that year. Conservative law students who were upset because they felt that the law in general and the academy in particular was biased toward liberals started speaking out and organizing. And what was remarkable about it was just within a very few weeks after their first conference, they began to organize chapters at other schools, and they grew very, very fast. They had an infusion of money from the Olin Foundation. They were off and running. When those students graduated, Edwin Meese, who was President Reagan's initially his White House counselor and then his attorney general, recognized the value of these young conservatives and immediately gave them important jobs in the White House and in the Department of Justice. And that really started the organization off with a bang.
Now, you've been interested in them for several years. In fact, your book came out in 2013. What triggered your initial interest?
Well, I had been reading about the Federalist Society and learning a little bit about them, but I realized that most people didn't know who they were, didn't know what they were up to, what they believed in, where their money came from, but at the same time, they had enormous influence. They had the White House counselor to George H.W. Bush when he was president was C. Boyden Gray, who later became a trustee of the Federalist Society. Working for Gray was Lee Lieberman Otis, one of the founders, and she was, in fact, vetting judges for the first President Bush. So I saw that behind the scenes, they had great power, but publicly, almost no one knew about them. And so I thought they were a good subject for research and writing.
Now, one of the things that your book discusses and that I think is a key to their really multi-generational success is the fact that they don't quibble over specific issues and internal differences, but they look really at the long picture. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, the Federalist Society is a big tent, and they have conservatives of all stripes, from the religious right, business conservatives, libertarians, all gathered together. Now, of course, these folks have many disagreements among themselves, but unlike the left, they have agreed to disagree. And so they get everybody in this big tent, and they cooperate on what they can cooperate on, and they help each other push their agendas forward, even if they might have disagreements about specifics from time to time.
In terms of the landscape of the federal courts, how have the appointments influenced that over the last couple of decades?
Well, the Republican presidents have understood very well the importance of judicial appointments. Edwin Meese, Ronald Reagan's White House counselor and later attorney general, said that a president has no greater impact on history than he does through his appointment of judges. The Federalist Society took that to heart. Their early view was, we'll change the law by changing the judges. And they started that in the Reagan administration when George H.W. Bush was president. They had people in the White House basically advising him on judicial selection, including one of the founders of the Federalist Society, Lee Lieberman Otis. When W. Bush was president, Brett Kavanaugh, who's now been nominated to the Supreme Court, for the first 2 years of W. Bush's presidency, Brett Kavanaugh picked judges for him in the White House. So they have infiltrated the selection process for many, many years, and that has resulted in judges who favor big business, dislike government regulation, dislike environmental laws, dislike laws that favor consumers. They are friendly to the church. They have allowed a greater degree of state support for religion than we've ever seen in this country. They oppose affirmative action. They don't think race should be taken into account in selecting people for colleges or jobs. In the international sphere, that's one area where they're completely aligned with Mr. Trump, which is America first. They believe very much in American exceptionalism, that we're different, that we're better, that we don't have to follow the rules that other people have to follow. And so really the whole package is something that they've been able to bring into policy through judicial decisions.
It seems as though these judges are the real activists, a term that the conservatives use so often to describe liberals.
Oh, no question about it. The Rehnquist Court struck down many more laws than really most courts had since going back to before the New Deal. You know, judicial activism is merely a rhetorical device to describe something that a judge does that the speaker doesn't like. Everybody who gets appointed to the Supreme Court says that judges don't make law, but anybody who goes to law school knows that judges do make law.
Can you talk a bit about the originalist theory of jurisprudence and how it's employed in the service of a right-wing agenda?
What the Federalist Society people have promoted, going back, again, Mies was a big proponent of this, Stephen Calabresi wrote a book about it, is the notion that we should interpret the Constitution according to the meaning that the words in it had in the 18th century. And that originally their idea was, you know, the intent of the framers of the Constitution, but they've kind of moved beyond the idea of original intent to the idea of original meaning. That we can go back and look at what words meant at the time and through that understand what the framers of the Constitution meant in what they were saying. The late Justice Scalia was a major proponent of this way of thinking. And, of course, that's a conservative view, because one of the things that's happened since the 17th century is that our society has embraced individual rights much more than used to be the case. The Federalist Society is much more interested in property rights, whereas the National Lawyers Guild is more interested in human rights.
Michael, I'm assuming that with the new complexion of the Supreme Court, we're going to just see more and more of what you referenced in terms of valuing property rights, corporations, and chiseling away at individual rights.
Yes. I mean, we could describe the Roberts Court already as the business court. Now, with the addition of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, these folks believe that the most important right protected by the Constitution is the right of rich people to do whatever they want with their property. You know, protecting property rights if you have property and if you're rich, but if you're an ordinary person, individual rights are much more important to you. And that's what groups like the National Lawyers Guild have put ahead of property rights. Human rights is the thing that we're concerned about. I think what we have to worry about now is that that's going to be cut back, and we're going to be, again, as we were before the New Deal, in an era of social Darwinism.
Well, they say that history goes in cycles, and we used to say in the Guild, bad times for the country are good for the Guild, in that we saw resurgence of activism and support for the kind of work that progressive groups were doing. What is your greatest fear right now for the country? Do you think that we're going to see an upsurge in people taking to the streets and protesting?
You know, I don't know if we are or not. People have been so beaten down. People don't have the health care they need. They don't have the jobs they need. A lot of people in this country don't have the basic nutrition that they need. So I'm concerned about that. My biggest fear is that America is in the waning days of the Roman Empire, and that everything that this country enjoyed when it was taking advantage of the rest of the world and exploiting Latin America and having its way with markets in Asia is coming to an end. And at the last moment, you know, the capitalist class and the people with power and influence are fighting tooth and nail to hang on to what they have. And with an egomaniac like President Trump in power, I just think the risks, not only for our country, but for the world, of war that we won't recover from are very great.
Right. You know, Michael, because of your experience and background in police misconduct, I'm always struck when Trump is so critical of our national intelligence agencies that his supporters are going to lose respect for those institutions. I'm not saying they're not flawed, but what do you see as the damage internally when we have a lack of respect for those agencies that are tasked with really safeguarding national security intelligence issues, given our precarious relationship right now with all the other nations?
That's complicated because we don't have much respect for those agencies to begin with. and the idea of invoking national security is something that the government usually uses to put down its internal critics. To my mind, what's going on here is that there is some relationship between President Trump and Putin and the Russians that has not yet been fully ventilated. We don't know exactly what it is. We don't know exactly what his game is. But it was interesting to me that former President Obama, speaking in South Africa, was talking about the rise of powerful leaders ignoring the wishes of their constituents. And that's kind of what we see on this stage with Trump and Putin.
Right.
So I think Trump's criticism of the intelligence agencies is part of an internal game that he's running to enhance his own power at the expense of really of the rule of law.
Right. And then, of course, his selection of Supreme Court justices are individuals that we expect are going to support a strong executive that will sort of worsen that problem.
Well, Kavanaugh has written about that. Judge Kavanaugh wrote an article in which he said he didn't think a sitting president should be prosecuted criminally, that the only remedy that you have for something that a president might do would be impeachment. And we know that impeachment is impossible as long as the president's party controls the House and the Senate. So, you know, it's a willingness to thumb your nose at the rule of law for the sake of having a powerful president. And I think that's very dangerous.
Michael, we just have a couple of minutes left. Any thoughts on whether Roe v. Wade will be overturned?
I think Roe v. Wade may well be overturned. It has been irritating to the conservatives since the Rehnquist Court that despite all the Republican precedents we've had, that they haven't been able to overturn Roe v. Wade. And so I'm afraid that may well be at great risk now. On the other hand, I would not like to see the debate over Kavanaugh reduced simply to concern about Roe v. Wade. As important as Roe v. Wade is, and as important as the right of women to have that autonomy is, there are so many other issues on the table that Kavanaugh's appointment is going to affect that I think we just need to keep our eye across the entire board of things that we need to be concerned about. Someone asked me the other day, why is it that when students organized in the 60s and there was a big movement of blacks and whites across a wide spectrum of issues, anti-war, anti-poverty, civil rights, why didn't that result in those organizations coming to power the way the Federalist Society has come to power? And I think the answer to that is that it's important to realize that the Federalist Society was invited into the government. It was invited in by President Reagan. It was invited in by both Bushes. It's been invited in by President Trump. The left-wing organizations have never been invited into the government and are never going to be invited into the government. If we're organizing on the left for people's power, for progressive issues, we have to recognize from the beginning that we have a much, much more difficult task than the right does when it seeks power. Because even when the Democrats are in power, they are a middle-of-the-road, centrist, a political organization that doesn't want to invite the left in, doesn't want the kind of changes that we want. So our job is very, very difficult, much more difficult than the job of the right.
That's a really important point. One of the other factors that I've been continually dismayed about is the failure of anyone in leadership to really take a bold stance and, especially in the Trump administration, stand up for what they believe is right. There's so much kowtowing and failure to sort of think outside the box or voice an individual thought. I think we really are suffering from a lack of leadership on many levels.
Well, I think it's the old story of the emperor's new clothes. I think that parable has a lot to teach us today. So somebody needs to have the courage to come out and say the emperor isn't wearing any clothes.
Right. Michael, your book was ahead of its time, The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. How can people get a hold of it? Because it's important reading.
They can get it on the Vanderbilt University Press website, which will route them to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and, you know, all the major sellers.
They could go to individual bookstores and order a copy.
Absolutely.
Which would be good.
And we'd love to see them do so.
Right. And what are you working on now, Michael, if there's anything you'd like to share?
Well, I'm continuing my work on police misconduct. Every year I update, along with my co-authors, the treatise that we publish for lawyers. And the thing I'm dismayed at this year is that I read all the cases that have been decided in the last year by the courts of appeals that deal with police misconduct. And this year I'm shocked at how many police killings of civilians I'm reading about. I mean, it's way more than it has been in the past. That just is a statistic that seems to be climbing. I know people are concerned about it, but we really have to find an effective way of doing something about it.
Are you still involved in the National Police Accountability Project?
Yes, I am. I'm on the board, and I'm on the executive committee of the board.
Well, Michael, it's always a pleasure to have you on. You have such open-minded political perspective and foresight, and we hope that people will run out and get a copy of the Federalist Society, because we're going to be seeing more of the blueprint that they created several decades ago.
Thank you, Heidi. It's always a pleasure to be on Law and Disorder.
All right. Have a great day, Michael.
You too.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.